Juno Afternoon is next. We'll talk with Ron Klein about his first Friday exhibit of colloidal photographs here at KTOO. We'll get details about the Art Council's juried art show with Sue Sloss. We'll find out about Perseverance Theater's Alaska Summer Theater Institute with Shona Strasser. And Stacy Paulson will be here with news about June events at the Nugget Mall. And finally, Nell McConaughey, a glass artist who will have a show this first Friday as well. Weather, rain likely for the next few days.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A recent study shows new information about how health officials in Saskatchewan, Canada, are providing support for First Nations people with HIV. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
It's called ATRAC, or Aboriginal Track, and its aim was to determine whether enough is being done to prevent and treat HIV. A survey was conducted between December of 2011 and June of 2012. Taking part in the study were members of the Aboriginal community, local health care providers, and AIDS groups. The Saskatchewan Health Ministry says there were 186 HIV cases reported in 2011, an 8% increase from the year before, and of those cases, 81% were Aboriginal. For the recent survey of more than 1,000 Aboriginal people who provided blood samples, 5% tested positive for HIV. Dr. Maurice Hennick is a deputy medical health officer with a local health region in the province.
The figures and the information that we have from the study are used to help support some of the healthcare services that we are providing.
The All Nations Hope AIDS Network says the survey is a good beginning, but the First Nations community especially wants health officials to go further. Native leaders say some of the services available are not much more than Band-Aid solutions, and more services are needed, for example, to help with the trauma and conditions that are facing Aboriginal people with HIV. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A public viewing is scheduled today in Anchorage, Alaska, for an Athabascan elder who fought a long legal battle over Native fishing rights in court and won. Katie John passed away last week at the age of 97. Ellen Lockyer reports.
Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller, who represented John in court, says John continues to be a role model for Alaska Natives.
She represents the Alaska Native determination to hold on to their way of life that is intimately connected to the land.
John received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 2011 for her advocacy of Indigenous rights and her ongoing efforts as a teacher of culture and language.
She's truly a female chief. There's a term in her language for a person of her role. It's pretty rare, kui'ah. And that's a high-status woman.
That's Dr. Jim Carey with the Alaska Native Language Center in Fairbanks, who worked with Katie John on efforts to preserve Alaska Native languages by developing an alphabet of the Otno-Athabascan dialect. John raised 14 children and 6 adopted children with her husband, Mentasta Traditional Chief Fred John. Katie John will be buried in Mentasta on Saturday. For National Native News, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Tony Gorman assisted in that report. An invasive snail is the latest threat to an endangered fish significant to the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe. Willie Albright reports from Reno, Nevada.
Recently, wildlife officials announced the discovery of tiny New Zealand mud snails in the river that feeds Pyramid Lake. Now the tribe has to develop a strategy to deal with this latest threat. Once established, there is no known way to eradicate the snails. Pyramid Lake Fisheries Director Albert John says they reproduce wildly and can rapidly devastate the water's ecosystem. The tribe has been bracing against the possible threat from invasive quagga and zebra mussels, but the advent of the snails was unexpected. John says Pyramid Lake is probably too saline for these invasive species, but they represent a real threat to the upstream spawning grounds of the kwiwi fish and Lahontan cutthroat trout. For National Native News, I'm Willie Albright in Reno, Nevada.
During this week in 2012, tribal, federal, and state leaders broke ground on the Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project in New Mexico. The project will deliver water to thousands of Navajo people. It will also bring water to portions of the Hickory Apache Nation and the city of Gallup. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Weather for today and through Thursday night, rain likely, with just a chance of rain beginning on Friday and through the weekend. Good afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and this is Juneau Afternoon. Our first guest this afternoon is Ron Klein, probably best known as a panoramic photographer. He will have an exhibit here at the KTOO building on Friday, which is First Friday, always my favorite Friday in Juneau. And we invite the public to drop by and see that exhibit. And the photographs are called, am I pronouncing this right, Ron, colloidal?
Colloidian.
Colloidian
is the chemical that is used to coat a glass plate, and it makes film when it dries. So it's, in a funny way, it's just modern, but it's not. It was invented in 1851, which is one of the earliest forms of photography. There is the daguerreotype, which is older, but a very nasty process, and you can't duplicate it because the daguerreotype is on a piece of copper, and it's polished like a mirror, and you can't print that. You can't shine light through copper. So you need a negative, and colloidian was the first method of making a negative, which allowed a photographer to make multiple copies.
So why have you delved into the wet plate process for photography?
Well, I've done not thousands, tens of thousands of glass plates for the State Historical Library, Winter and Pond and Case and Draper and those guys, and could see something happening in that old time period that I really liked. And it just isn't done today. There's something about those old emulsions. They have a different latitude, a different response to color. Film, and a glass plate is film. It's just on a piece of glass instead of a piece of flexible film. Film, in the old days, could only see blue light. Red looks black. It's very strange. So I kind of like that. I kind of like the look. And photography then becomes almost timeless, because if we like the things that were done 150 years ago and they're still good today, why aren't we doing it today? You know, I mean,
I looked at the list of chemicals used in creating photographs, and they were lengthy and some looked pretty unpleasant. Is it hard to find those chemicals? How do you get set up to do collodion photography?
If somebody came to me today in Juneau and said, I want to do collodion, I would say, well, it's easy and it's hard. It was hard for me at first to figure out how to get some of these chemicals, because I actually ended up getting things out of Western Auto and Fred Meyer's and places like that, and playing with chemistry, converting them into the chemicals that you need. When you can actually buy this stuff and have it shipped as a special hazmat order, I mean, it doesn't come through the air. Colloidian, to make this chemical colloidian, it was nitrating cotton. In the old days, this was called gun cotton. It was used as an explosive. In fact, gun cotton is six times more explosive than gunpowder is today. So you take this gun cotton and dissolve it in diethyl ether and straight-grained alcohol. So now we're already dealing with three of the terrorist list chemicals here, so you have to be a little cautious. But, you know, I've been in photography in business in Juneau doing it for, starting to crowd 40 years. That's a little scary. So I have a track record. I mean... As a business, I can order things that a normal person would have more difficulty getting. Still, it's hard. It's expensive. I've got right now $300 worth of collodion the raw chemical sitting on the dock in Seattle trying to figure out how to get it here. You know, it can come up on the barge, but, I mean, that's what it takes. You have to juggle these things around. So
this is a major investment, both of your time and of your finances, to shift into this kind of photography. What is so significantly different about it that a viewer might notice it and appreciate it?
Wow. Well, if you looked at a Matthew Brady Civil War image, you know, we all like pictures of Abraham Lincoln and those things. I mean, I'm not there yet. Those guys were good. Those guys could pour plates and make it almost as if it were modern today. I mean, it was so even and so, you know, fabulous. So I like the challenge of that. But I also like, again, the tonality of this material. It's silver rich. There's a lot of silver involved, and modern stuff doesn't have that. I know the digital people hate me because I just say digital is soulless. It just doesn't have the ability to run wild like collodion. You know, I pour a glass plate and it's got blobs on it and dust in it and it lumps and it doesn't develop right, and that's okay.
You like that imperfection?
Well, it just tells you that, no, I don't like the imperfection. I want to make it perfect, but I can live with the imperfection. But in digital, if it was banded or blotchy or something, you'd be up all night in Photoshop trying to fix it. You know, you got to make that perfect photo, and I'm free of that. I don't have to make the perfect photo. The prints that are on in the show are by no means masterpieces of tonality, of all the things that I learned when I was in college doing photography. It isn't even close. I mean, they had rejected me. I got an F in my first photo class for some of these things. But it works. It really does work. I mean, I'm excited about it. I really am. So
I know that when Matthew Brady and those of his generation were making wet plate process, they had to do it in the field on the spot. Mm-hmm. It's something that they couldn't pack away and take back to some studio somewhere. How are you doing that?
Well, that's it. Wet plate photography, which is what collodion photography really is. You have to pour this collodion stuff on the glass plate, dip it in a silver nitrate solution, let it soak and get light sensitive, and then take it out and put it in a plate holder, and then put it in the camera and expose the image, and then quickly take it out in your tent in the field in the dark and develop it before it dries out. Because if it dries out, it seals the chemicals from reacting with the coating, and it won't work. So that's why it's wet plate, and you have to do it with all the stuff in the field.
A lot of your pictures are taken outdoors, it appears.
Right.
Did you do it in the field?
Yes, I did. The first, this is the second exhibit of collodion that I've had here, actually. We did one, 3 years ago, something when I first started, all done out of my studio. It was outside, but my studio was right behind my back, and I was jumping in my darkroom. All of the images in this one were done away from there. You know, I had to make a cardboard box dark room, or, you know, I've gone over to Hoonah and taken pictures. I've went to Oregon to the Pendleton Roundup and down the coast to California.
You went to China. One of the pictures, one of the largest ones.
Yeah, it is a
panoramic.
That's not collodion, but that's...
Why were you in China?
Well, that was fun. That was, boy, you know, you can think about those old days of how cool it was when the Chinese were first coming to Juneau to, you know, it was just, everything was just breaking up. Cooper was governor, and it was, you know, just those kind of weird days. And so, anyhow, we went to meet some of these Chinese people, and I gave them panoramic pictures. That was in the 80s, the 1980s. And then one of the trips back, they invited me to come to China and have a show of my work. And so we took them up on it. And there was a big exhibit of panoramic photography by Ron Klein in Harbin, China, that Governor Cooper and the governor of Heilongjiang province cut the ribbon to it. I mean, it was a big deal. It really was.
So that's an artifact from that event.
And it's just, it is. It's just, to me, it's... It shows continuity to what I'm doing now in a funny way, and I love the photo that I put on display. I was told, and of course they may have just said that to pump me up a little bit, that I was the first foreigner to ever have a show of photography in China. And the more I think about it, they may not have been not I mean, it probably was. I mean, this is 1986. I mean, I don't know anybody else that went to China to have a show of photography.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I have one last question for you. I noticed your T-shirt today, and you told me you were the past president of the International Society.
And charter member. I was in with the original bunch of photographers in the United States. The whole thing of panoramic photography when using the old circuit camera was really keen. Everybody sort of stuck to themselves. They wouldn't share information. And then all of a sudden they started, you know, we say, hey, wait, this is – let's get together and figure out how to do it so we can do it in color, or we can do this or do that. And we had this meeting, and then next thing you know, it became an association. And over the years, I became president.
So how many panoramic photographers are there that you're aware of in our country?
Oh, now there's billions because it's digital. You know, but at the time when I was using the circuit camera, there was 35 maybe.
So it was rare.
It was rare.
It was quite rare.
Well, they only made 1,000 cameras in the entire life of doing it. It took getting them organized and then getting newer cameras made because there weren't any. We were using cameras from the 1890s because that's what was there.
Well, we're lucky to have your show here and to be able to see.
I hope so. I hope you guys can come and see because I used that old panoramic camera at the Pendleton Roundup. I did a kind of a cool photo And it fits with these collodion portraits. I mean, I think you guys will like it. So
I already do. I took a
sneak
peek.
Good.
Thanks for joining us, Ron. And your show will be here on First Friday. That's this Friday at 4 o'clock here at KTOO Studios. 4:30.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, June 5th. 2013. On this day in 1851, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin began its serial run in an abolitionist newspaper. It ran in weekly installments for 10 months, generated some interest among opponents to slavery, but didn't reach a larger audience until it was republished as a book in 1852. Many critics dismissed the novel as sentimental, and several characters gave rise to persistent stereotypes of African Americans. Even so, it attracted thousands of Northerners to the abolitionist cause. It sold 300,000 copies in the United States in its first year in print. Today is the birthday of one of the great men of letters of the 20th century, Alfred Kazin, born in Brooklyn in 1915. Grew up in the Brownsville section of that borough, and said, "We were children of the immigrants who had camped at the city's back door, a place that measured all success by our skill in getting away from it." He loved books, spent much of his time sitting on a fire escape, reading whatever he could get his hands on. When he was a senior in college, he read a book review in the New York Times that made him so angry, he got off the subway, went to the Times office, and complained to the editor in person, who was so impressed he got Kazin a job writing freelance book reviews. He studied literature at Columbia and started writing a survey of American literature. The result was his book, On Native Ground. It became one of the most celebrated books of literary criticism of the decade. When asked why he spent so much of his life working as a critic, Kazin said, "I am dissatisfied, profoundly so, with the world as it is, but I would be dissatisfied with any world, and I'd hate to lose my dissatisfaction." And it's the birthday of poet Federico Garcia Lorca, born in Granada, Spain, 1898. He published a book of poems based on gypsy folklore called The Gypsy Ballads, and it made him Spain's most popular living poet. His poems appealed both to the literary critics and the common people, and many of them were set to music. Garcia Lorca once heard a prostitute singing a song in the street, and he was shocked to realize that he had written the lyrics she was singing. In 1998, on the 100th anniversary of his birth, the Spanish government flew a helicopter over his home city of Granada and dropped 100,000 leaflets of his poetry. Lorca said, To burn with desire and keep quiet about it is the greatest punishment we can bring on ourselves. And here's a poem by Dylan Thomas entitled Being But Men. Being but men, we walked into the trees afraid, letting our syllables be soft for fear of waking the rooks, for fear of coming noiselessly into a world of wings and cries. If we were children, we might climb, catch the rook sleeping, and break no twig, and after the soft ascent, thrust out our heads among the branches to wonder at the unfailing stars. Out of confusion, as the way is, and the wonder that man knows, out of the chaos would come bliss. That, then, is loveliness, we said. Children in wonder, watching the stars, is the aim and the end. But being men, we walked into the trees. A poem by Dylan Thomas entitled Being But Men from his collected poems published by Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering writing about finances, food, art, wine, and culture from around the world. More at wsj.com/celebrateweekend. And this is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping that you will join us again next time.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement, available at various locations in Southeast.
We're talking with Sue Sloss from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. She is the coordinator of the gallery there, and she's here to talk about the Juried Art Show, which will be featured during First Friday. Of course, that's this week. Sue, tell us a little bit about how the process occurred to conduct a juried competition, really, and how that progressed, and then a little bit about whose pieces were chosen and that we'll be able to see this Friday over at the Jack.
Okay, this is the fourth biennial Juried Art Show. It happens every 2 years, and let's see, I wasn't on staff for the first two, but I came in and helped hang the show for the third biennial Juried Art Show. We have a great online system now. We put out a call for artists, and they upload their photographs to our online website. The juror was selected. His name came to us maybe through a board member, but anyway, someone suggested Nicholas Glannon of Sitka to be the juror. He agreed, and he looked at the online photographs and selected the pieces that way and just let us know via our website which pieces were in. And I can...
Do you know how many total entries there were?
We received 51 entries from 18 artists, and Nicholas selected 14 pieces of artwork by 12 artists. So it should make for a really interesting show. I have to say I was pleasantly surprised by his selection, because looking over the entries, I thought it would be a difficult process. So the artwork he selected is from the following artists: Timmy Johnson, Carol Baker, Joy Lee, Rob Royce, Terry Robus, Christian Carrillo, Barbara Craver, Pua, Elizabeth Kench, Terry Gallant, Rachel Jusler, and Patrice Helmar. And I can't speak or say much about why he selected these pieces, because I haven't actually spoken to him personally, but we're hoping and expecting that he will show up on Friday between 4:30 and 7, or actually 4:30 to 5, and talk about his selection and award the first and second places of the show.
What are the prizes? Is there a... Not sure. It's going to be a surprise. The prize is a surprise.
But I have to also let you know that this year we came up with the People's Choice Award. So what we're going to have is ballots in the gallery all month, and so people who come and view the show have a chance to vote for their favorite. So that's going to be a fun addition to our show this year.
Now, you said that he looked at photographs online, but the photographs were pieces of original art. They weren't photographs themselves, is that correct? Meaning...
Well, right,
okay.
Yes, digital images of the photograph, of the artwork.
And was the artwork all paintings? Was it a mix of 3D artwork like sculpture, or did it have to meet certain criteria in order to be considered?
It was a mix, and that's really interesting when you're looking at a digital image of artwork, especially 3D. We did have one ceramic artist. She put in photographs of three different pieces, and she was allowed to put multiple photographs of one of her pieces, because on 3D you want to have a 3D, you know, you want to see the different sides of the artwork. We had a number of multimedia pieces, and it's always interesting when you put out a call for artwork. You have no idea what you're going to get, and generally you'd expect a variety of styles, subject matter, and mediums, and that's exactly what we got. We got this quite a different selection of styles. We have some contemporary, we have... some traditional art forms, we have some modern pieces. So it's going to be, I don't want to give too much away, I just want people to come and be pleasantly surprised.
And will all of the artists whose pieces have been selected, will they be there as well?
Yes, most of them are in town. I have two artists who are out of town, so they won't be present, unfortunately.
As the gallery coordinator, I guess one of the things... I'd like to ask you, if it doesn't put you on the spot, is there something lost in translation when it's a photograph of a piece of work rather than the work itself that's being judged? Does art give a feeling when you're in the presence of art that can't be felt or intuited through a photograph?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I've been looking at these digital images online for months, and then finally, just the last 2 days, the pieces have had actually been coming into the office, and I'm surprised. Some are much larger, some of them in paintings and oils and acrylics both. The depth of the color is so much more pronounced than what I see on the thumbnail photos online. So yes, yeah, definitely. And it'll be interesting for Nicholas to come over and actually see the pieces in real life.
How long will the show be on display at the Jack?
Oh, for the whole month of June through July 1st, we will be taking it down. And so the People's Choice Award, we are going to announce the winner on June 30th at 5 p.m. Arts and Humanities Gallery at the Jack.
Will there be another event at that time, or...
No,
just
I think
for that purpose.
Right. I think we've come 5 o'clock. We will have counted up all the ballots.
And so can people vote throughout the month? Meaning visitors who show up after the First Friday event?
Yes, and we have a lot of tourists walking through, usually on their way to the State Museum or on their way back, and so it's going to be a way for us to encourage them to go look at the show and cast their vote as well. So this is not just a local People's Choice Award. It's going to be tourists, visitors.
And do we have to give our word that we won't vote more than once, or is that encouraged?
I'm not sure. I've been thinking about that. How do we handle that?
I wonder. I've seen some online contests where they say, vote for your favorite, you know, whatever it is, every day. You can go online every day and vote. So I assume we'll be using old-fashioned paper ballots in this way?
Yes, yes.
And what time on Friday does it start? 4:30?
4:30.
4:30 to 7.
Reception.
And there are
yes.
A total of, you said, 14 artists?
14 pieces by 12
artists. Okay. And can you give us a hint about the most unusual one in the bunch? What would you say to those who are thinking, should I go? What would they be missing if they didn't come?
Well, they'll just have to come and see.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to the People's Choice Award, and I assume that we'll be able to announce that at the end of June, then, amongst those dozen artists. We've been talking with Sue Sloss. She is the gallery coordinator for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, and we're talking about the Art Council's Juried Art Show, which will open on First Friday, 4:30 to 7 o'clock, over at the Jack, and you'll have a chance to hear from the juror who judged that show, Nick Gallinan, hope I'm saying that correctly, from Sitka, as well as to meet some of the artists and then vote on your favorite as well. That's 4:30 on Friday. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome Shona Strasser from Perseverance Theater. We're going to be talking about the Alaska Summer Theater Institute, or ASTI. And when I first read about the program, Shona, I was thinking it was the STAR program, which has occurred here many, many years. But there's a distinction between STAR and between ASTI. Why don't you tell us what that is and then tell us a little bit about the Summer Theater Intensive.
Yeah, so they're actually two totally different programs, and they happen every summer. The ASTI program is new as of 3 years ago, so this is our third year. And the Alaska Summer Theater Intensive is actually for adults. So this is for adult people, you know, adult people in town and actually out of town, too. So we get some people from out of town who want to do training, more intensive training in the theater realm. And so we offer playwriting classes in the evening. We offer voice classes, and that's actually any voice. So it's not singing in particular, but it's stage voice, so it can help with singing for sure. And then also during the day, we offer an acting class, and this acting class focuses on viewpoints and Suzuki. And these are very, you know, very specific techniques that a lot of actors train in throughout the country. And throughout the world, actually.
As an intensive, that sounds like it must be every day for several hours a day for consecutive days in a row. Tell us about the schedule.
Right. So it's 1 week, and we're actually going to begin Sunday, June 30th. So we begin Sunday, June 30th with kind of a meet and greet, a barbecue, and this is what the week looks like. And Monday through Friday, except for July 4th is in there. So we actually have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Friday we do classes from 1 to 10 p.m. And you can just take a night course if you're a person who works during the day, or if if you're a person who works at night, you can take a day course, or you can take the whole thing.
I imagine there's a schedule online.
Of course, yeah.
And where would they find that?
PerseveranceTheater.org.
Okay, very good. Talk about the cost a little bit, if you just wanted to do a nighttime workshop, or if you were in for the entire program.
We like to think of them as tracks. So you could take up to two tracks. And those tracks each are $250. And that cost mostly covers our instructors, and our instructors are top-notch instructors coming up from down south. And these are people that are working consistently in the professional theater world and who are getting high accolades. And so we're really lucky to bring these artists up here.
How many different visiting artists will you have then who will be leading?
We'll have three different artists. One of them's name is GM Giamani. And he's going to teach the Suzuki and the Viewpoints portion during the day. And he is working with the famed City Company. And the City Company is really huge in New York and just doing some really cool, innovative work. So we're lucky to have him. In the evening, we have Micah Espinoza. And she is a Fitzmaurice voice work specialist. And she travels all around the world basically teaching people how to diversify their voice, which I think is really fascinating because she actually takes it from the approach of who are the people that, or not who are the people, but how, in what ways has your voice been kind of stamped, right? So, like, how do you release those stamps and how do you use the most of your voice? And she's just been fabulous to work with thus far. And then the playwright instructor is a woman named Deepika Guha. And we're really excited to have Deepika up here because she's actually a former student of Paula Vogel, who, of course, is really, you know, kind of...
Pulitzer Prize winner, debuted her play, was it Learning How to Drive here in Juneau?
Learning How to Drive, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and she's highly recommended by many, many theater artists, and she's a huge up-and-comer. So we have a lot of really great instructors who are pretty hot stuff right now.
Does one have to have experience of any sort in order to... be involved?
Yeah, not at all. Actually, some of the people involved have tons of experience, and some of the people involved have very little. There's one guy who's like, I've been not doing this for 20 years. Can I come back? And we're like, yes. And the instructors know that's the case here, and that is often the case in Juneau. And that's kind of what I think is really the great thing about Perseverance is that we do provide an opportunity for really experienced artists to practice their craft, but it's also a place where new people can try out new things.
Are you recruiting any particular kind of learner that maybe is underrepresented in the Perseverance stable of performers or contributors?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where anybody is always encouraged to come around, and cost is not something we want to be an issue ever. So, you know, everybody is encouraged to come and participate. And if cost is an issue, please give me a call, and I will be more than happy to come up with some scholarship money to help out. There's a lot of local businesses that really support us in scholarship efforts.
And what about the limits on the sizes of each of the workshops? What's the maximum number of people that will be allowed to attend? I imagine you want to keep it somewhat intimate, but also accommodate as many people as you can.
Yeah, we usually get about 15 to 20 is, you know, where we max out per class. So, and, you know, we haven't maxed out yet, and we're kind of not at a place where we're, foreseeing that. And actually, that's great. We're actually at about 15 per class almost every time.
Just about the right size.
Exactly. It's a great, you get lots of one-on-one attention, so it's nice.
So you said this is the third year that the ASTI has occurred. Have you, as a theater, experienced, I'll call them ASTI graduates, who have progressed or moved up to being in one of the Perseverance productions? Has that become a next step for some folks?
I would say yes, and there's a lot of people who, you know, the playwriting is a really kind of tricky one because you take one class and you write part of a play and it's like your play is not done yet, so that's a little tricky, but a lot of the actors that do participate in ASTI do perform on our main stage or on our second stage, so it's just kind of one of those things where, you know, if people want to get involved at Perseverance, we're going to say, great, and ASTI is one way to make that happen.
Who thought of ASTI, and why are you doing it?
Yeah, well, Anita Maynard-Losh used to work here at Perseverance Theater a while ago. She's been gone for about 8 years, and she works at Arena Stage with Molly right now. And she really kind of started this idea of needing a place for adults to come and learn because there are a lot of opportunities for young people. But what we found, you know, it's sometimes it gets tricky up here to find other other people to play with, and as far as who are to learn from and all of that kind of stuff. So just to find new training opportunities for adults. So it was kind of her idea, and this was about 20 years ago, so there was a program for a while, for about 10 to 15 years. And then after Molly left and we kind of had some transition, it continued with Peter Dubois for a while, and then kind of dropped off as we were developing different programming. And then when Art and I came on board, we actually came on board at the exact same time, and it was one of those things where, like, okay, we need to reinstitute this because we really want it to be a company for Juno artists. And
so
how
it's
do we
revival
train them?
Of sorts, then.
Exactly.
Have you looked at your registration list to know if anybody is coming from outside Juno? Have you been able to attract
We have a couple of Canadians, I have to say. I'm pretty excited about that.
I think they call that an international reputation, then.
That's right. Yeah, we have some Canadian artists coming up, and then mostly other Alaskan artists.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't you give us the particulars one more time, place, and of course it's Perseverance just across the bridge in beautiful downtown Douglas, and dates and the price.
That's right. It's Alaska Summer Theater Intensive. It's June 30th to July 7th. It's at Perseverance Theater. The price is $250 per track, and there's three different tracks that you can take. There's playwriting, there's voice, and there's acting. And for more information, you can look up perseverancetheater.org, or you can give me a call. My name is Shona at the theater, and that's 364-2421.
Thank you so much, Shona.
Thank you.
Trouble no more, Lord, I'm, oh, I'm trouble, I'm trouble on your mind. Oh, I can't be satisfied, and I, oh, but I just can't keep from crying. Well, I know my little baby, she's gonna jump and shout. That old train came late, and I come walking now, Lord, I'm, oh, I'm trouble. Trouble on your mind. Oh, I can't be satisfied, and I, oh, I just can't keep from crying.
Summertime is the right time to register and enroll for classes for the fall semester at the University of Alaska Southeast. Whether you are just starting college or working on your degree, sign up now before classes fill up. Check out all UAS has to offer on campus and online in the new fall 2013 class schedule at various outlets around town or at uas.alaska.edu. Classes begin September 3rd. This message is brought to you by UAS.
Well, that was Harry Manx, wonderful slide guitarist. He'll be an artist at the Outland Music Festival in July. With us now on Juno Afternoon is Stacy Paulson. She's the promotions manager at the Nugget Mall. What's up for June, Stacy?
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet.
Well, the first event we have is our Father's Day Golf. It's a miniature golf tournament, and it's completely free to all family members. So you just show up at noon on the 15th, which is the day before Father's Day. Register, get your scorecard, and go around for 9 holes of golf. We've got great prizes, including a $250 grand prize in Nugget Bucks. And then our second prize is $75. Third place is $50. We've got lots of runner-up prizes, and we've got hole-in-one prizes. That.
When will that start? Is it when the mall opens? Is that at 10 on Saturday?
It actually starts at noon on Saturday.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it goes until 3, so show up before. In between, noon and 3.
And is it just on Saturday then?
Yes, just on Saturday.
So don't show up on Father's Day.
No, we're going to let you enjoy Father's Day with your dad doing events.
And it's totally free. Is there an age limit on that in terms of little someone can be this tall?
Yeah, you can see that on the radio, right?
Exactly.
No, they have to be able to hold a golf club.
Okay, so at least as tall as a golf club.
Yeah. And we do have left and right hand clubs too. So yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Now, how do you set that up? Do you have ramps that are made, or
we do? We have golf holes that are made, and then the stores volunteer to host a hole. So we've got 9 stores that are hosting the hole, and they donate a prize for that hole, and they also supply the hole in one prizes. So if you get the ball in on your first go, you get a hole in one prize. And I never know what they are from year to year, but they're always fantastic. So, and it's fun. It's just a surprise.
I bet. Yeah. And what else is going on in June?
Well, we have our Festival of Fun. This is a charity carnival. So what happens at the Festival of Fun is we have a lot of nonprofits in Juneau. They need to raise money. They need to make people aware of their causes and who they are. And this festival allows them to come to the mall, and they run one of the games, and they make all of the profits from that game. So we've got tons of games. They're really fun carnival games, including darts, Frogger, cork guns. We even have a live fish pond, and every year We Fishy donates the fish for this live fish pond, and it's one of our most popular events.
Have you arranged for us to be able to dunk someone well-known in the community,
like
the mayor? I think we need to call him and ask him. You know, we throw the baseball, ka-ching, and we raise money for a charity, perhaps, of his choice.
We do have the baseball that goes into a milk can, but you know, we don't have the dunking machine yet.
The dunking could be fun.
Yeah, we'll have to come up with that.
What day is that, on a particular day or throughout a weekend?
It's actually 2 days. It's June 28th from 5:30 to 7:30, so that's an evening.
Oh.
And then again on June 29th, which is the Saturday, and it's from 10 a.m. until 4:30 on the Saturday. So it gives you 2 opportunities to drop by, help support your local nonprofits, charities, and have a lot of fun. We also will have food and a pie-eating contest on Saturday. That starts at 1 p.m. And you can sign up for that at Vintage Fair Cafe.
You can't go wrong with a pie-eating contest.
No.
No matter what type of pie it is.
And it varies from year to year. Sometimes she has 2 types that you can choose from.
All of those things sound like a lot of fun.
It's a lot of messy.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Napkins are free. So the Father's Day Golf Tournament is the day before Father's Day.
Mm-hmm. 15th.
On Saturday the 15th, and it's for 3 hours from noon to 3, and it's free.
Yes.
And then a couple weeks later, Friday night the 28th, from 5:30 to 7:30, and then the following day is the Carnival of Fun to help our local nonprofits raise some dollars.
Mm-hmm. Festival of Fun, and that's the tickets are only $1. All the games are just $1 each. So it's, you know, low cost and great for a family to come.
That sounds
lots
very affordable.
Of great prizes, too. We had donations from Fred Meyers, the Women of the Moose helped us out, Sea Dogs helped us out, and a couple of the stores at the mall, Pinky Seafood and Nugget Alaska helped us out. And then the Garnet Preschool stepped in, and the Emblem Club. So we got sponsorship this year to buy some really great prizes.
Our community is so generous.
It is. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us, Stacy. Sounds like June will be fun out at the Nugget Mall.
Thank you.
Well, we're visiting now with Nell McConaughey. She is a glass artist who has been a member of the Juno Artist Co-op for the last 15 years. And she has a show coming up on First Friday, which, of course, is the day after tomorrow. She has brought with her some really beautiful samples of some glasswork, including some vases of various shapes. The shapes are really different, four different shapes and different colors, and a candlestick holder. And I said, oh, is that etched? And she said, no, it's
sandblasted.
So tell me a little bit about that process of sandblasting. I mean, I picture you right now standing in your garage with like a headpiece on to protect you with the fire burning and the sand blasting, but it's got to be a little more civilized than that, isn't it?
Well, that is one method, and it can be done that way, but a little bit more controlled method, as I have a sandblasting cabinet. So the sand is inside a cabinet that's airtight, and I use a compressor for pressurized air, and I use an abrasive material inside the sandblaster. Each piece, before it goes in, has been, there's a, I'm losing my words here. I put a design on each piece that resists the sandblasting, so it's either sandblasted or not when it's finally finished. So that resist is already on the piece. It goes in the sandblaster, close the lid, turn on the compressor, and blast each piece individually.
How long does that take?
Yeah, it depends on the piece, how much etching is done on each one. Some can only take a minute. Others may take 5 to 10 on these smaller pieces. I've also done big panels, and I've also done sandblasting on location. I've done a staircase out at the NOAA facility a few years back, which was a real interesting project to do on site.
What drew you to this particular type of art? Had you started in another medium and then decided to explore sandblasting, or what led you?
Well, mostly what I've done for the last 15 years is jewelry and mirrors, using a lot of stained glass and found objects, and that's what I'm mostly known for. But for this show, I decided to do something totally different. I was out at the recycling center, and there's this huge bin of glass. There's beautiful bottles in there, and I just hate seeing them just get mashed up. So I decided to do something different, and I collected a few bottles, various sizes, shapes, colors, and cut them. They're all ground on the edges, and then each one is individually sandblasted. Something totally different. I've never done it before. It kind of is a throwback to the 70s, if those of us that remember the 70s, where recycling was a big thing. Now it's called upcycling because it's different, right?
Each of these pieces truly is unique and beautiful. Is each of these from a bottle that you retrieved from the recycling bin?
Well, not all of them went into the recycling bin because it's probably not ideal to go climbing in there after things. But I do collect bottles, and friends of mine collect bottles, and so they are all recycled glass bottles.
Let me ask about the color. We have a tall, semi-square vase here, and the bottom compartment is red. Did you choose it that way, or are you able to color the glass as part of the process?
Well, that came that way with the original contents from a local box store, shall we say.
And your show will be part of the First Friday exhibit. Is that at 4:30 as the other programs are around town?
4:30 Friday at Juno Artist Gallery, our cooperative gallery in the Senn Building.
You must contribute time there because that's part of being part of the co-op, is that right?
Exactly.
And will you be there Friday?
I will be there Friday.
Very good. How many pieces will you have ready to show?
There's about 40 total, but it is summertime in Juneau. Things will not be held for the month, so we'll start selling them as soon as they're up.
Meaning that it's a very busy month, both with our locals as well as the tens of thousands of tourists who travel through.
So if you want to come down and see the show, get out Friday or as soon as you can.
Very good. If somebody wanted to learn more about this process, where would they start?
They'd be welcome to contact me. I'm in Spiral Studio in the phone book right here in town, or spiral@gci.net, or my phone number, 463-6992.
And will you have other types of pieces at the show, meaning I'm looking at the gorgeous jewelry that you're wearing right now. You said that's typically what you're known for. Will you also have those on display?
Year-round, I do have a display of jewelry and mirrors at Juno Artist Gallery. I did do a number of mirrors that have recycled items in them, whether it's beach glass or old pottery or fishing lures.
Is that one of the most unusual things you've ever used?
Maybe not the most unusual, but certainly striking and noticeable.
I'm wondering, can you make a living as an artist full-time in Juneau? Are you able to do that?
So far, 14 years and going.
That's pretty remarkable for a small town.
I feel lucky and very honored to be able to do that.
Do you sell pieces outside of Juneau, say on a website? Does that contribute to your livelihood as well?
I do have a website, and I do travel around the state. I usually do shows in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Sitka, and I have a few wholesale accounts through other galleries, mostly in Southeast.
So we see here the four vases. Now, each a different color, green and blue, and then the clear, the red, and then a pure clear one that is a fantastic shape here. And then the two candlesticks. This is the top of a bottle, isn't it?
It is.
That you
it
have
is.
Turned into a candlestick. I just noticed that's very clever. Will we see any other objects that you will have created other than these two particular categories?
Specifically for this show, it's just the vases and candle holders.
Okay.
But there will be a plethora of other things, both made by myself and the other members of the gallery, that folks are welcome to stop in and see.
What would be the price range that folks can expect to find on the items?
These are actually relatively inexpensive. The candle holders are only $12. The vases range from $28 to $42.
I love the designs. Very different and very beautiful. Now, anything you'd like to add about this particular show that you're going to have this Friday?
Well, I'd like to, with the upcycling idea, I'd like to get other people's ideas on what they can do with glass bottles. So if you come to the show on Friday night, tell me what you think you can do with a glass bottle.
Or other found items,
or
perhaps.
Or other found items, right.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Nell. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and we'll stop by and see the show 4:30 Friday at the Juno Artist Gallery, which is in the Senate Building on Franklin Street.
Thanks, Lori. See you there.
You bet. Weather and out. And this. Well, let's take a look at the weather. It's not very promising for the next couple of days. I see the same words used over and over again. Rain developing, highs around 57, and mostly cloudy. perhaps a little less likely to rain on the weekend. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Shona Strasser will be the host, and you'll hear about the Juno World Affairs Council's presentation by Governor Sean Parnell. You'll find out about the Goddess Life with belly dance and burlesque dance instructor Dolphina, get a preview of Friday's slideshow about a trip south, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, music, and more, that's tomorrow at 3 on KTOO News. If you miss the Juno Afternoon or you want to listen again, you can catch it and other local, statewide, national, and international news at ktoo.org. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K26AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K22BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. And KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, KXLL at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Obama has named U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice to be his new national security advisor. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Rice will replace Tom Donilon, who's stepping down from the post next month.
Rice has been a loyal and trusted advisor to Obama since his first White House campaign. The president says he's happy the U.N. ambassador is coming back to Washington to oversee foreign policy and national security in the White House.
Susan's the consummate public servant. A patriot who puts her country first. She is fearless. She is tough.
Rice angered Senate Republicans last year when she delivered faulty talking points in the days after the deadly attack in Benghazi, Libya. Their opposition prompted Rice to drop her bid to be Secretary of State, but the White House post does not require Senate confirmation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The new acting head of the IRS has placed two employees on administrative leave ahead of a congressional hearing into excessive spending on conferences. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, an inspector general's report found nearly $50 million was spent on conferences over 3 years.
The inspector general's report looks at IRS spending on conferences and focuses on a 2010 conference in Anaheim. According to a statement from the IRS, the inspector general notified the agency that during the conference there was a party inside a private suite where, in violation of government ethics rules, food was provided free of charge. The acting IRS commissioner, Danny Werfel, says there was, quote, clearly inappropriate behavior involved in this situation and immediate action is needed. The two employees were placed on administrative leave and the IRS has begun the process of removing them. According to a congressional aide, one works in the division responsible for implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the other in the Small Business Self-Employed Division. Tamara Keith, NPR News, the Capitol.
A building collapse in downtown Philadelphia killed one person and left more than a dozen others trapped in debris today. At last word, authorities had pulled most of the people from the rubble, though the search efforts were continuing. Witnesses had different accounts of what caused the building to collapse, but the building was under demolition at the time. The incident occurred at 22nd and Market Streets in the heart of Philadelphia's center city. Stocks took a major hit today. All three of the U.S. stock market indices falling more than a percentage point. The drop was led by companies that are involved in fields like banking, mining, and chemical manufacturing. Alex Young with S&P Capital IQ explains what pushed stocks lower.
Recently, some of the economic data has actually softened up, and so that brings up a different risk, which is, you know, are we in for another one of these economic